Stay at home has done its job, but it's getting to be time to get back to work, says Governor Abbott. A blueprint for the incremental reopening of Texas. That's today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. With support from Rand Group, software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. More on the governor's plan to gradually get Texas back in business, plus the role of testing and contact tracing. Also, how a city that brands itself the wedding capital of the world hopes to outlast the wedding bell blues brought on by COVID-19 concerns. And from blue bonnets to blue lights, screen time in Texas under quarantine. Is too much still considered too much? All those stories and then some when the Texas Standard gets started right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this 28th day of April 2020. I'm David Brown. Hope you've had a good Tuesday so far. A few days ago in this very space, I mentioned four things some experts believe states need to have before reopening for business. Number one, the ability to test all who show symptoms of coronavirus. Number two, enough beds in hospitals to avoid use of emergency facilities if there's a rebound in cases. Number three, the ability to monitor known cases. And number four, a sustained reduction in coronavirus cases for at least 14 days. It's worth noting that these guidelines, while unofficial to be sure, came from the American Enterprise Institute, generally considered a pro-business conservative-leaning think tank. So how does Texas compare? So far, there's been no shortage of hospital space, and the number of new cases appears to have peaked on or around April 10th, depending on whose numbers you're looking at. But that's part of the issue here. Testing has been sporadic, and the numbers of new cases in Texas does not appear to have dropped for 14 consecutive days. Nonetheless, Governor Abbott says his stay-at-home order has done its job. And yesterday, he said at a news conference, it's time to get back to business. The governor set Friday, May 1st, for the limited reopening of restaurants, movie theaters, and malls. Not everyone's convinced. Some workers may not feel comfortable going back to work just yet. But if a business reopens and an employee chooses not to return, the Texas Workforce Commission says they become ineligible to collect unemployment compensation. The governor says the reopening won't happen all at once. At first, reopenings will be limited to 25% capacity, with a second phase of reopenings in mid-May, assuming no COVID-19 flare-ups. But this means having reliable data. What do healthcare experts say about the governor's blueprint? Edgar Walters has been writing about this very subject for the Texas Tribune, where he is health and human services reporter and an associate editor. Edgar, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
You spoke with 10 infectious disease experts this week about four steps they say the state needs to take before it can gradually reopen. What are the four steps you're hearing?
Yeah, so first, as you mentioned, we need to test and continue to expand testing to a greater portion of the population. Second, we need to isolate those who test positive. So that means that they are sick with the virus and they need to be held in isolation at home but away from their family members. Third, we need to track down everybody that they may have come in contact with, which is a fairly labor-intensive process. You know, figuring out everybody who they have interacted with over, you know, a period of several days. And fourth, those people need to, who they may have been exposed, they need to quarantine themselves for 2 weeks. So it's a fairly big undertaking.
Yeah, I'll say contact tracing is what you're describing there in steps three and four, it sounds like. So if you get into what the governor announced yesterday, what lines up with the advice that healthcare experts are telling you there?
Every expert that I've spoken to has said it would absolutely be ideal if Texas were testing a larger share of its population. And it remains true that compared to other states, as a fraction of our population, our testing rate remains low. However, the good news is our percent positive rate, so that is the percentage of those tests that come back indicating that a person does have the coronavirus, has remained flat and has remained around 10% or lower, which is a good sign. So what experts are watching for is as that testing increases, and they're hoping that it does continue to increase fairly quickly, that that percentage positive rate either stays about the same or ideally falls. Now, on the other steps, you know, isolation, for example, that's where we're really encountering some economic pressures on families. So what we need to, you know, be ensuring is that as people are encouraged to come back to work or, and become, in some cases, ineligible for unemployment benefits choose not to go to work, they need to have the resources where they can actually isolate themselves. And you could think about it like if you have a working class family and, you know, it's potentially a very crowded household, the ability to actually self-isolate and, you know, keep an adult, say, who has the virus away from the rest of the family is no small undertaking.
Absolutely. But I want to loop back to contact tracing, which seems to be the bigger challenge for Texas. That's, as you say, quite an undertaking.
Absolutely. The general consensus of the experts I spoke to is this is kind of the limiting factor in Texas right now. It doesn't so much matter how many people you test if you're not following up to see, okay, the people who test positive, who could they have exposed? And so there was an announcement from the governor this week that they're ramping up the state's contact tracing workforce very rapidly. In the next couple of weeks, they're going to bump that workforce up to about 4,000 people, which is about a fivefold increase and is great. That said, you know, some of the experts I talked to really hoped that we might have an even more ambitious plan, potentially bumping up that workforce by a factor of 20 or more.
So what's the overall feeling from the medical infectious disease community about the governor's tiered strategy?
First, I think they're pleased that, you know, Texas is going to wait for these results to come in and then sort of evaluate and see, okay, have we made enough progress where we can reopen more businesses? Now, there is a little bit of hesitancy from these experts that that time frame may be a little bit too ambitious. So what they're worried about is that the delays in a person first becoming sick, showing symptoms, and then having to actually get test results back if they are tested, that takes several days, and so there may be a lag.
Edgar Walters, Health and Human Services reporter and associate editor at the Texas Tribune. Edgar, thanks so much.
Thank you.
In response to the coronavirus pandemic, the Trump administration has effectively sealed off the border to asylum seekers and restricted immigration. One change affects migrants who've been sent to wait in Mexico as their asylum cases play out in U.S. immigration courts. A warning here for listeners, this report from KERA's Mallory Falk includes details of a sexual assault.
In international law, there's this concept called non-refoulement. It's the idea that if somebody comes to your country seeking protection, you can't send them back to a place where they'll face persecution. This concept came about after World War II.
Much of this sprung out of the Holocaust.
Aaron Reichlin Melnick is with the nonprofit American Immigration Council.
When many Western countries, the United States among them, sent Jews seeking refuge back to Nazi Germany, and many of those people then perished.
Non-refoulement became the backbone of U.S. asylum law. It protects people from being sent back to a dangerous place. For asylum seekers now in the Remain in Mexico program, it's been a Hail Mary to try to get out of Mexico, where many fear for their lives. They can request non-refoulement interviews, and if they pass, they can pursue their asylum cases from inside the U.S. But coronavirus has complicated the process. For people like Alejandra, she and her 13-year-old daughter have been living in Juarez for more than 6 months after fleeing violence in Guatemala. They've tried to keep busy, cleaning houses when they can to earn a little money. Alejandra's daughter also passes the time making YouTube tutorials, like how to solve a Rubik's Cube or save videos to your cell phone.
Empecemos. Yo aquí tengo la...
Alejandra asked that we not use her full name while her asylum case is still pending. She says life in Juarez was challenging. Then, last winter, something terrible happened.
Yo fui al centro a comprar pizza.
One afternoon, she went to pick up pizza and a new SIM card for her daughter's phone.
Era domingo. Eran cuatro en la tarde. No era noche.
It was Sunday. It was 4 p.m. It wasn't night. And true, I was alone, but downtown. It wasn't what I thought was a dangerous place.
She says she'd just gotten off the bus when a car approached. A man got out, covered her mouth, and dragged her into the back seat. Alejandra says he raped her, then threw her out of the car. Since then, she and her daughter have been living in fear.
We would only go out to go to the store, together, and then back home.
Alejandra had a hearing for her asylum case in March. This is the moment when she planned to ask for a non-refoulement interview. That's how the process usually plays out. Then the coronavirus pandemic struck and her hearing was postponed. In order to get a new court date, she had to show up at the port of entry. She wondered, could she request a non-refoulement interview then?
We haven't received any guidance from the federal government about whether the non-refoulement interviews are officially continuing or have been halted.
Brooke Bischoff is an attorney with Las Americas Immigrant Advocacy Center who helped Alejandra during this time. A Customs and Border Protection spokesperson told KERA that non-refoulement interviews are now being handled on a case-by-case basis, but said he couldn't share details about how the government determines who receives an interview. He claimed that information could be, quote, exploited by human smugglers.
Now, essentially, total control has been given to whoever is at the port of entry handing out new hearing dates.
Bischoff says there's no way to know how many people are requesting a FEAR interview and being turned away. Alejandra actually got a non-refoulement interview, she thinks because her lawyer had already filed paperwork. During the interview, she explained what happened to her in Juarez and why she was afraid to stay there.
Lo que habían resuelto era que yo regresaba a México.
But ultimately, she and her daughter were sent back to Juarez. Bischoff says she's not surprised. She's seen many people who experienced violence get returned to Mexico.
Non-refoulement interviews, in my view, were kind of this very bare minimum safety net. It was never a fail-safe option to get people out, but they did kind of offer one shot at hope in particularly egregious situations.
As for Alejandra, she says she's in limbo now, waiting for some unknown point in the future when the courts can reopen.
I would like to be with my family that's there in the U.S. I don't want to live like I am now. I'm not moving forward. I'm here in this place that makes me so afraid.
It's not clear how long she'll be here, as court dates keep getting postponed. I'm Mallory Falk in El Paso.
All right, let's check in with Wells Dunbar, our social media editor. What are Texans talking about on this Tuesday, Wells?
Well, as we heard, retail stores, restaurants, movie theaters, and malls can reopen Friday at 25% occupancy per those new rules from Governor Greg Abbott. Lots of folks chiming in about this one via Twitter. Rohit writes, I appreciate that we have to reopen at some point and that he's trying to be methodical about it, but I think it's way too soon and puts a lot of folks in the difficult spot of having to fire people or give up unemployment, etc. Juan adds that even under normal circumstances, operating any business at only 25% occupancy can't be very profitable. And Bud Simpson tweets, all I know is if you go to a restaurant that's operating on such small margins, you'd better tip your server like you were Elvis and you'd just run out of Cadillacs to give away. Good advice there. Seeing dozens more comments coming in on the Texas Standard Facebook page. I'll be back with more later in the show.
You know he will, folks, so you need to reach out to us and let us know what's making news in your part of Texas. Just look for Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice. Wells Dunbar, social media editor, back in 35 or so.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with small and mid-sized companies by helping to unify their businesses and achieve digital transformation. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. The number of COVID-19 cases among people in Immigration and Customs Enforcement custody continues to grow, as do calls from advocates for the release of nonviolent detainees. In an El Paso detention center, officials report 5 people have tested positive. Now attorneys for some immigrants held there have filed a lawsuit seeking their release. KTEP's Angela Kucherga spoke with women who say they're in quarantine at the El Paso facility.
After hearing they'd been in daily contact with someone who'd tested positive for COVID-19, 2 ICE detainees reached out to me to express their concerns. Frightening is how the first woman describes the situation. The second woman said they ate meals and mingled with that individual. Both say they're among 17 women quarantined in a tent at ICE's El Paso Processing Center. These women say so far they do not have symptoms, but each suspects a dozen other women in the same tent behind what they describe as a wall or partition are sick because they're wearing face masks. The second woman says the individual who originally tested positive is now back, living among the 12 women in isolation, which leads her to believe they must all be sickened by COVID-19. So far, ICE has only confirmed 5 cases among people in custody at the El Paso facility. In response to questions from KTEP, ICE provided a statement saying, quote, detainees with fever and/or respiratory symptoms are placed in a single medical housing room or isolation room designed to contain biological agents such as COVID-19. Further, ICE said, detainees who do not have symptoms but meet the Centers for Disease Control criteria for risk are housed separately in a single group, depending on available space.
ICE has the power to make determinations, you know, on a day-to-day basis as to who might be released.
Rebecca Sheff is with Texas Rio Grande Legal Aid in El Paso. She's on a team of lawyers seeking the emergency release of 6 immigrant women from the detention center. All are at high risk for serious illness or death from COVID-19 because of their age or underlying medical conditions.
No matter what shuffling of women inside the facility might be going on, our clients cannot practice social distancing. There's no way in the current conditions that they're held in the detention center that they can remain 6 feet from other individuals at all times.
According to the lawsuit filed in federal court Friday, those conditions include sleeping in dormitories and sharing bathrooms, showers, and telephones. The first woman calling from inside the detention center described similar conditions. She's not part of the lawsuit, but says those in her quarantined group have no protection like masks or gloves or enough soap or disinfectant. The second woman said their beds have been spaced further apart, but precautions were only taken after detainees became visibly sick. In El Paso, I'm Angela Cocherga.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, providing community relief actions for the COVID-19 crisis, including early dividend distribution to eligible policyholders. More at texasmutual.com/dividends.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. By proclamation of the Texas legislature, Dripping Springs, just west of Austin, is the wedding capital of Texas. So what happens to a wedding capital during a pandemic? Someone who's learning a lot about that firsthand also was one of the people who helped get Dripping Springs crowned the wedding capital in the first place. Kim Hanks is CEO of Whim Hospitality, a Dripping Springs-based company that provides everything from floral arrangements to catering to tents to actual venues like Camp Lucy for weddings, South by Southwest, Circuit of the Americas, and a whole lot of other special events. Kim, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited.
So your business model, obviously, is very date-specific. What has happened to you since the stay-at-home orders went into place? Could you describe what's happened?
Well, so the events industry is very seasonal, and there's probably 2 really big seasons of the year, and that's spring and fall. And in the spring season, you have South by Southwest, Fashion X, the ballet, a lot of galas. Whenever that canceled, all of that revenue was lost. And for us, it was around $6 million. And we rely on that money to push us through summer and winter when there's not a lot going on. So for us and for the events industry, that was a really devastating blow.
There's not a whole lot that you can do about something like South by Southwest. But when it comes to weddings, I would imagine some people don't want to give up on that altogether.
No. So we are working really diligently with our clients and we're moving our dates because, as you can imagine, our brides and our couples, they're still in love and they still want to get married. So there's this push and pull. It's like a dance where you're trying to juggle all of these professionals that are behind the scenes to make that event magic. So you have about 8 to 12 professionals that you're trying to juggle their schedules to reconfirm a date.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about layoffs here. How bad has it gotten?
You know, for us, we laid off about 60% of our staff, which equates to about 150 employees. Wow. And then the 50 that we kept, we had to put them on a limited schedule. And, you know, I lived through the recession, our last recession, and this is nothing like that.
But there's also this aspect of, you know, you want to maintain Dripping Springs as the wedding capital of Texas. That's an important part of the branding of the city and so on and so forth. But what happens to people who are laid off? I mean, they've got to make ends meet. They've got to find ways to, you know, to tide themselves over, right?
Yes. So I am on the board of directors for the Visitors Bureau, and we are trying to keep really great communication, but I'm also doing Zoom calls with all of the wedding professionals, and we're trying to talk about how do you move and not cancel so we can protect some of the revenue for our wedding professionals, because the wedding capital of Texas is not going to go away.
Now, I hear that you've pivoted some of the business, at least in part. You've offered your tents to be rented for emergency management use and folks needing them for temporary testing sites and that sort of thing. Has that been helpful at all?
I mean, it has, because since our tent division of WIM Hospitality has been seen as essential, we have been able to build medical screening tents in Round Rock and Austin and Kyle. We also provided that drive-through tent for the Texas Food Bank distribution site. So it feels good, and it feels good for our employees to feel like they're essential and feel like they are part of getting Texas better.
If there's anything that you could ask of government right now, what would it be?
I've reached out to a lot of our representatives to give us a seat at the table so we can talk about how we can open up in a safe manner. There's so many of us out there, you just don't know, you know, how many people are in the live events industry. Austin is known as being the live events capital, so we need to be out there. We need to start receiving an income so we can be strong again.
Kim Hanks is CEO of WIM Hospitality, a Dripping Springs-based special events and wedding planning company in the wedding capital of Texas. Kim, good to talk with you. Thanks so much for taking a few minutes out on the Texas Standard.
Thank you very much.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. Families can save for tuition, room and board, books, and other qualified education expenses at eligible schools nationwide. Learn more at texascollegesavings.com.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. American Airlines is rolling out enhanced aircraft cleaning procedures this week. The Fort Worth-based carrier announced Monday it will also begin providing customers with face masks and sanitizing wipes or gels in early May. Starting Friday, flight attendants will also be required to wear masks. The Episcopal Health Foundation is launching a variety of tools to help organizations and people recover from the COVID-19 crisis. The Houston-based group announced today it will be making more than $10 million in grants and zero-interest loans available to nonprofits and community-based clinics facing financial pressures. The foundation's also planning an in-depth research project to identify what resources Texans need to get back on track following the pandemic. President and CEO Elena Marks says the outbreak has highlighted existing inequities.
The people who are suffering the most during the COVID pandemic are the same people who suffered the most prior to the pandemic. And they're the same people we saw suffering the most during Harvey.
Marx says resources need to be focused on helping the most vulnerable, including people living in poverty and communities of color. Galveston residents can now exercise on the city's public beaches between 6 and 9 each morning. The new policy took effect Monday after the city council narrowly voted last week to partially reopen beaches for activities such as running, swimming, and surfing. Marissa Barnett, a public information officer for the city of Galveston, says the first day went off without a hitch, but she reminds people access to the beaches is still restricted.
If a person is found in violation of the order outside of those hours, it is considered a Class C misdemeanor, and that carries a $500 fine.
Currently, stationary activities are prohibited at all times on the beaches. And firefighters in West Texas have contained about 50% of a wildfire that started last week south of Interstate 10 near Ozona. The Holcomb Road fire has burned nearly 26,000 acres so far. Robin Griffith is with the Texas A&M Forest Service that's leading the effort.
It's burning in some really rough terrain, so It's really hard to put a date on the end of it, but we do have crews working day in, day out. We have a night shift that goes on to patrol overnight.
Nearly 200 personnel from fire departments across the state have been deployed to fight the blaze. Griffith says they are taking precautions to prevent the spread of COVID-19. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, providing community relief actions for the COVID-19 crisis, including early dividend distribution to eligible policyholders. More at texasmutual.com/dividends.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. In our current state of caution, a lot of work and learning has been moved online. So has connecting with friends and family. Entertainment also often involves one of those screens. It's enough to give most adults a feeling of overexposure to that dreaded blue light. But what about kids? Before this epidemic, we talked about limits on screen time and worried about its impacts on development. What about now? About a year and a half ago, we told you about the book Tech Generation, Raising Balanced Kids in a Hyper-Connected World. Today, we check in with co-author John Lasser. He is an associate dean in the College of Education at Texas State University in San Marcos. John, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thanks so much.
I heard from someone who's an expert on kids who said, look, you got enough to do. Don't worry so much about screen time. What say you?
Well, I think it's important that we recognize right now is a very different time. Parents need to be patient, flexible, and collaborative with their kids. It's never helpful to be over-controlling. Even so, too much screen time is too much.
So what's the recommended level of screen time? And I would imagine it sort of depends on the age of the kid, right?
It does vary by development. The American Academy of Pediatrics has really said that it should be avoided for kids 18 months and younger, although they have an exception for video conferencing with family members who are distant, which is a way to stay connected. For early childhood above 18 months, they say no more than an hour a day. Again, it's going to vary by family composition, needs. I know a lot of families that have kids of multiple ages struggle to keep younger kids off of screens when older kids have access because they're in the same space.
I'm sure you're familiar with the moral panic that we had in this country back in the 50s and 60s. Too much TV time could lead to all sorts of ills. A lot of that early research was debunked and or written off as sort of, you know, too anecdotal to be considered scientific. What is the danger, the serious danger, when it comes to kids spending too much time in front of screens?
Well, we really haven't been able to demonstrate that scientifically because, in part, you can't ethically do a controlled experiment where you take a group of kids with zero screen time and a group of kids with a bunch of screen time and follow them over time to see what happens. So it's really hard to draw causal relationships, and we haven't seen a lot of that. But what we do know, and again, anecdotally, is that when screen time begins to eclipse other important behaviors and functions like sleep and physical activity, we start to see problems. We also don't know the direction of causation. So are kids who are anxious and depressed more likely to spend more time on screens, or does screen time contribute to that kind of anxiety and depression? A lot of questions remain unanswered.
I want to make sure that I understand something here. Is there a qualitative difference between screen time used for online learning and communicating with loved ones, or should we consider it sort of all the same, like, you know, sort of aggregate screen time?
We like to think of screen time that is either actively creating. So, for example, you could be on a screen making art, making music, writing a novel, versus passively consuming, binge-watching Netflix, for example. So that's one way of sort of differentiating. Screens have a lot of benefits. They can educate, inform, and entertain. The problem is many of these devices and apps were designed to keep us hooked. And adults have this problem too, compulsively checking our phones for texts and emails and social media. So it's really powerful. But no, not all screen time is the same.
You know, we assume that this is a temporary situation, what we're all having to endure at home. But do you have any concerns about the longer-term impacts of this period in our history?
Well, I do, because we're spending more time on screens right now, and I think we have good data to support that the streaming is on the rise right now. What happens when we return out of shelter in place and out into the real world? Will it be hard to tear ourselves from the screens? I think parents right now have an opportunity to encourage their children to creatively problem solve and look at alternative choices and ways of getting outside, even though we're supposed to stay home, and still have physical activity and social engagement in real time.
There are a lot of parents who may be listening to you right now thinking, well, this sounds good, and I know where you're coming from on this. On the other hand, I'm up to my eyeballs with work of my own, I'm trying to manage 30 different things at once, and I've never had to do this kind of thing before. And honestly, I need that screen as a pacifier. What do you say to them?
I say I have a lot of compassion for parents that are stuck at home right now with kids, and that they should practice some self-compassion. They should go easy on their kids and easy on themselves and try to maintain some harmony in the family.
John Lasser is an associate dean of the College of Education at Texas State University. He's also co-author of the book Tech Generation, Raising Balanced Kids in a Hyper-Connected World, focusing on the balance there. Dean Lasser, thanks so much for speaking with us on the Texas Standard.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools. Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
This is Lee Bird from El Paso, Texas. I am a publisher. My husband and I started Cinco Puntos Press 35 years ago. I'm a writer of novels and fiction, but I also have these beautiful grandkids. I have 7 of them, and I've written stories for each one of them, mostly. I have 3 more to go. But this book, Birdie's Beauty Parlor, is about Emma, Birdie Bird. And when she was young, she's now 20, she's the sort of girl that when I was taking care of her, I would get a little tired, as grandmas sometimes do. And I would say, Emma, let's do beauty parlor. And so our way of doing beauty parlor was for me to lie down on the bed and for her to just take every single piece of makeup I had and lay it on me. And it never lasted long enough for me. She got tired sooner than I was ready. But it was always the most wonderful experience. And you end up not looking too beautiful, but covered up with makeup. I wanted to commemorate that in this book. And every time I see the Francisco's illustration on the cover with Birdie's big red lips and her pigtails flying out, I just love it, and I love that she's so dang bossy. I just love the way she throws things around, and she pushes her grandmother around, and she grabs her grandmother's face and pulls the hair chins out. That was always the granddaughter's work, was to look at her grandmother and say, Grandma, you've got hairs on your chin. And so that was what I threw in there, too. Now, the reason Francisco Delgado did this book is he and I also did another book together. The first book we did together was Juanito Counts to 10, and that was about my grandson, John Andrew. John Andrew is very affectionate, so it was about counting kisses. And instead of using John Andrew as a model, Francisco used his son, Pedro, because Pedro was there, and that was how it went. So I don't think we said, well, we need a kid of color, we need anything. So that's how we work together. He uses his kids to model, and I use my grandchildren as the inspiration. Kids, especially around here, and kids all throughout the Southwest, they don't want to see Little Red Riding Hood or in Spanish. They want to see their own cultural stories. And that it was bilingual made a lot of sense. Now, we have done books in English and in Spanish as like a dual edition, but they never sold as well for us. The bilingual books have always been the best-selling books, and so we just wanted Birdie's Beauty Parlor to be bilingual, so it's all about grandmas and granddaughters. This is Lee Bird. I'm the author of Birdie's Beauty Parlor, and I am listening, as always, to the Texas Standard.
You're on Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. Surgery, medication, therapy, just a few approaches to healing. Tiffany Riley and Dick Monday prescribe humor. For over 20 years, they've been helping young patients in North Texas laugh with encouraging results. Despite hospitals having restricted access right now, KERA's Miguel Perez reports the self-described clown doctors have found a way to keep kids smiling.
Hospital elevators are sort of like green rooms for Tiffany Riley and Dick Monday.
That's when Dr. Slappy lets one rip in an elevator.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, it's just the worst place to do that.
It gives the pair a moment to prepare before visiting with kids. They were at Cook Children's Hospital in Fort Worth the day I first talked to them in early March. Riley, or Dr. Slappy, was sifting through a roster of patients.
Things that are really helpful are if they have autism or if they're blind or if they're deaf. We'd rather not know everything. If you're carrying around a lot of diagnoses in your head, I think it's harder to find the comedy. You're thinking about what they're going through.
They enter every room with just enough information, and what follows is pure improvisation.
I don't know. Let's see. Let's find out if we can come in. Oh, my goodness. You guys are in the middle of doing stuff. Hello.
Hi.
Hey,
a 3-year-old boy with a developmental delay is in the middle of physical therapy. His doctor is trying to get him to sit up. Monday and Riley burst into song, and the boy's eyes just light up.
Oh, you did it! Yay! Hey!
That was so much work.
Good work.
That was so much work.
Wow. Yeah.
While Riley and Monday don't have medical degrees, they are trained to use their clowning skills to help hospitals reduce the stress and fear patients might be feeling. The Laughter League, the nonprofit that the pair are a part of, is the only professional healthcare clown program in Texas. Dr. Ray Quigley with UT Southwestern Medical Center is one of their biggest advocates.
I think the one word that describes it the best is it's real, true empathy. They can flip it and have a kid in charge. Well, they can do that because they really understand where the kid's coming from.
A lot of the work is observational, reading the room, using props, music, or physical comedy to engage with patients.
Once they start thinking in that forward motion where they're helping us and telling us things, that's when we know we've gotten to the place that's actually doing some therapeutic work because it has empowered them.
But how do you do that if you can't be in the room with them? Cook Children's, like hospitals everywhere, has since restricted access to direct caregivers and medical staff. So yeah. The clowns have turned
Five,
to the internet.
4, 3, 2, 1.
Hello there.
Hello.
Here we are. Hey there.
They're working with hospitals to hold virtual visits with patients. Now, while the technology might be new, helping kids through a crisis is not. The pair has been tested before. Working for the Big Apple Circus in New York, one of the first circuses in the country to have a healthcare clowning program.
And it was dress rehearsal day, September 11th of 2001.
And I saw the picture on the AOL page of a plane running into a tower. I said, we should turn on the TV and see what's going on. And putting on my makeup in the trailer and really asking yourselves, what is my purpose now? You know, a clown.
Riley and Monday realized then how critical their work could be after a tragedy.
Kids had this incredible desire to tell us what happened. And we realized that we were great listeners and that healing was happening just from them telling us about what happened.
Riley hopes that, once again, they can create brief moments of levity for kids living through the current pandemic.
The real reason that I'm able to keep doing it is that what comes back, what the energy that comes back from the kids kind of disperses any of that sadness or that negativity, because they are resilient. Kids are magical, especially.
Now, while they can't be there in person, Riley and Monday can keep the magic alive online. I'm Miguel Perez in Dallas.
Looks like Southwest Airlines could use some cheering up right now. Dallas-based airline reported its first loss since 2011 on this Tuesday. Dallas News reporting that Southwest has parked 350 planes and is burning through $30 million a day. Read all about it at dallasnews.com.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you. Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, where Horned Frogs strive to be a force for the greater good. Stories of TCU faculty, student, and alumni changemakers can be explored online at leadon.tcu.edu.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. The Harvard Business Review is among many publications talking about one clear change the pandemic has wrought upon the American landscape, what is likely to be a fundamental shift in healthcare. Before COVID-19, a tangle of laws put tight rules on where and how healthcare could be distributed, to whom and by whom. Telemedicine, for instance, frowned upon by many critics, became essential and accepted. And the notion of who can be a healthcare provider has expanded, too. How else has this crisis caused us to rethink healthcare, and what else might change? Rita Cash is professor of health policy and management at Texas A&M School of Public Health. Professor Cash, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you.
With a sort of all-hands-on-deck need for healthcare providers to battle this pandemic, it might seem counterintuitive to imagine that it's causing hospitals to close and doctors to be furloughed at the very time when they seem to be needed most. Why is this happening?
Through social distancing, as you know, we closed many businesses. That included clinics and also elective surgeries and elective procedures. And so as we close these businesses, specialists don't have work, and so they were furloughed. About 50% in some hospitals of healthcare workers have been furloughed in the month of March.
So what we're talking about are services that often really add to the bottom line, the budgets of some of these facilities. And then there's the element of doctors and nurses who are just finishing their schooling and starting out on their careers. How's this affecting them?
Exactly. You made a great point. These services are revenue, top revenue producing services, elective procedures and surgeries usually make up for the monies lost on the emergency visits and intensive care unit side. Mm-hmm. So when you get rid of these revenue producing services, then the hospitals suffer as well. And we also know that COVID-19 patients are much more resource intensive. So we're also seeing hospitals losing money on these patients who stay at the hospital longer.
But does this mean that certain people in certain specialties, certain new doctors and new professional nurses may not get the sort of experience that they might otherwise have received because of these changes?
Absolutely. It has affected bedside teaching for residents in order to reduce spread of the virus. A lot of bedside teaching has discontinued. We also see medical students graduating early and put in place to help out in high surge metropolitan areas, not really prepared just yet.
So I guess a lot of people must be thinking at present, what does the American healthcare system look like once this is over?
There is conflicting messages when you look at physicians and physician shortages, basically is our concern. We already are experiencing shortages. Is this going to make things worse? And we are seeing two different sides of this story, retired physicians coming back to work. On the other side, we see physicians close to retirement considering, well, after this all blows over, maybe I should retire early. We don't really know what's going to happen after the pandemic, but we know we already are suffering from shortages. We have physicians shortages even before the pandemic. So after this, considering how the virus is also being contracted by healthcare workers and their recovery, coming back to work temporarily, short-term as well as long-term, it is a concern.
What can be done at this juncture to minimize the disruption, or is there a kind of a Band-Aid, for lack of a better term.
As you know, we've been studying rural hospital closures, and this is before the pandemic. The only access point for many geographically isolated populations are already closing because they have a hard time with enough surgeries or services that are revenue generating. And so with the pandemic, we're concerned about rural hospitals closures more than we're already experiencing. And so coming out of the pandemic, we're hoping that we start planning towards an improved public health infrastructure.
Beta Cash is professor of health policy and management at the Texas A&M School of Public Health. She's also co-director of the National Science Foundation Center for Health Organization Transformation, or CHOT. Professor Cash, thanks so much for taking time to speak with us on the Texas Standard.
My pleasure.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Wells Dunbar is monitoring the talk of Texas, as he is wont to do, since he is our social media editor. Wells, what are you seeing?
Hey, David. Well, we're getting dozens more comments on the Texas Standard Facebook page about the governor's plan for an incremental opening of Texas businesses. Yeah, beginning this Friday, Rachel Elizabeth has some strong words about the plan. She writes that, "I live in Tarrant County where the case numbers are still rising, and that's only based on a very inadequate number of tests we do have. Apparently, Texas doesn't give a damn about the CDC guidelines to have 14 days without a rise in cases before reopening at the most basic levels." And Governor Abbott certainly doesn't give a damn about the countless numbers of people who will be exposed to this virus as the result of his actions, which she says hamstring the ability of local governments to enforce restrictions that make the most sense for their communities, that order from the governor overriding any such local restrictions. Jonna Blackley has a different perspective. He writes, "Different politicians follow different advisors. At least by allowing some businesses to open, the governor is giving people a choice. Use them or stay clear." He adds, "If it turns out that the easing of results leads to an upturn in infections, then it can be rolled back." Lastly, Jerry Helfand, just another comment here. He says it's a meaningless gesture to the businesses that would generally go under if they lose, say, 50% of their capacity, but very meaningful to the governor's base. He's trying to have it both ways, he says. And so an interesting conundrum here: when some of these businesses open on Friday, and not all of them are going to. We've heard from some businesses that say there's not enough time, they haven't prepared adequately. Yeah. It'll be interesting to see those businesses that do reopen, whether or not they get the business that they anticipate. So
a lot of folks all over across the country watching Texas to see what happens here. I know I was reading the Los Angeles Times this morning. They said they were paying close attention to what happens in theaters for some obvious reasons. I don't know if you saw this in the New York Times here. Mm-hmm. They've just posted up hot spots across the nation, and apparently the highest among the cities with the highest average daily growth rate of coronavirus cases, two Texas cities, Amarillo at number 5 with 456 recent cases and a daily growth rate of 18%. Also, Abilene with 198 cases, daily growth rate of 12%. So pretty alarming, but not as bad as it is in Iowa and Sioux City. 1,000 recent cases, daily growth rate of 131%, which means that cases are doubling every eighth of a day.
Yeah, stunning.
I'm sorry, don't mean eighth of a day. I mean 8/10 of a day. Forgive me. That's almost once doubling almost every day is what they're trying to say there.
Yeah.
Pretty stunning. Pretty stunning stuff.
Definitely so. And, you know, obviously continuing to upend the way we approach life day to day. So many more comments, but as you can hear the music turning up there, it's time. We're running out of time, but I'd advise folks to check out the Facebook page for lots more on this and other topics there on the Standard.
Yes, you know what to do. Absolutely. Just go to TexasStandard.org and we'll get you connected. We're out of time, but we're going to be back here tomorrow. We hope you'll join us. Till then, I'm David Brown along with Wells Dunbar wishing you a terrific Tuesday.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Woldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington Family.